Hey, how good is that? We've got some glorious new graphics as well. Well done to the production team. And welcome to The Muckrakers, the show where we strip the day's big talking points down to their bare bones and devour the red meat of pure debate as we focus on the stories that matter to you wherever you're listening or watching from around the world. Today, we're going to discuss a few heavyweights, whether there will ever truly be justice for the victims of the NHS blood scandal. Were the ICC right to issue an arrest warrant for Benjamin Netanyahu and others? And is the cashless society an inevitability? And you can call us. We'd love to hear from you. Here's how you can get in touch.
This is the way we're going to be heard.
From the US and Canada, call 1-888-201-6425. From the UK, call 033-0024-1026. And from Australia and New Zealand, call 1-800-670-310. Free speech is alive and well on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Alive and well indeed it is. And if you do have any thoughts on the topics we talk about today, or even if you want to raise something completely different, do get in touch. Today, the Mudwreckers are made up of myself, me, Andrew Eborn, and two TNT heavyweights, we're spoiling you, Rick Mann and James Freeman. Welcome, gentlemen. How are you doing?
So far, so good.
So good. Yeah. Looking forward to this.
I'll tell you what, it's an absolute joy. We started yesterday, heavyweights yesterday, even heavier weights today. It's going to be interesting. And let's get those discussions going. Well, Britain's Day of Shame. That's what Rishi Sunak was saying. He's described the inquiry into the NHS infected blood scandal as a day of shame for the British. The inquiry accused doctors, government and the NHS of letting patients catch HIV and hepatitis. About 3,000 have since died and more deaths will follow. The inquiry said victims have been failed not once, but repeatedly by the very agencies that were designed to protect them. The Prime Minister told the House of Commons he was sorry for the failures. Well, was that enough? Gentlemen, why should Rishi Sunak apologise when this was the responsibility of previous governments, the NHS and faceless civil servants? Let's start with you, James.
Wow, this is just another scandal, isn't it? On top of other scandals, we've seen the post office, the blood scandal. There's loads of scandals. And the thing is, every time, Rishi Sunak wasn't in government when this scandal took place. But they keep on saying, oh, isn't it terrible what the British establishment have done? The fact that they covered it up. And, you know, the implication is that would never happen now, would it? Which is a load of baloney. I'm going to talk, instead of Rishi Sunak, I'm going to talk about the British Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, because he said yesterday on X that the infected blood scandal is the worst example of an establishment cover-up that he's ever seen. And he speaks as a former health secretary who campaigned against many such cover-ups. He says that around 3,000 deaths and tens of thousands of lives were ruined because of unaccountable people in power and the fact that they refused to admit they got things wrong. Well, listen, I couldn't let him get away with that. So I replied to that tweet pointing out about the COVID jabs cover-up that he's involved in, pointing to an interview that I did with Doc Malik last week. And guess what? I think everybody agrees with me because the number of likes that I got actually beats the number of likes that the Chancellor got for his original
post. That right?
So nobody.
How many likes did you get?
Oh, I think it's up to about 500 now, and he's on about 300. But it's right. Pretty embarrassing for the British Chancellor, isn't it?
Yeah, no, and absolutely. Rick, it is extraordinary, isn't it? What are your views?
Well, I think he's doing a disservice to the magnitude of this scandal here when he said it's a day of shame for Britain. In the same breath, he goes on to say that it's a day of shame for the British state as he apologised for the failures of successive governments over the infected blood scandal reaching back as far as the 70s. So I would have expected him to say it's been decade after decade after a decade of shame. And of course, then you ask the question, Andrew, well, why would Sunak come out and apologise for this? Obviously, he didn't have his hand in it directly, at least not that we know of. Well, of course, he's doing anything he can to get his ratings up at the minute. They're catastrophically low. So any PR scheme, any virtue signalling that Sunak can do, Fishy Rishi Sunak can do at this time, of course, appearing contrite, appearing apologetic, appearing dismayed and disgusted at what has gone on in the past on behalf of previous British governments, taking the torch, as it were, and apologising on their behalf, just reeks of virtue signalling. I don't think he gives a damn about any of those people that have been affected. Look at the people that are being ongoingly affected by the NHS crisis at the minute. He doesn't have any apologies to make for that. He's telling us how things are getting better. So I take everything Sunak says with a hefty dose of salt.
Yeah, it is interesting. And hearing Keir Starmer get up afterwards as well. And I've been talking to a lot of the victims for some time now, and the devastating effect it has, not just on them, but on their families. And actually, remember the sort of time in the 70s and 80s, there was a real stigma about AIDS. And so it wasn't just the medical deficit, if you like. It was also the societal one as well. People were shunned, and it was absolutely scandalous. And it's scandalous on two fronts. One, it's scandalous the amount of time it's taken to deal with it. But also, it's scandalous the cover-ups which have become, and they were devastating in the report yesterday. And we'll continue to speak to some of the victims. And I'm sure if anybody's affected, do get in touch with the show. We'd love to hear your story as well. But it's yet another institution, isn't it? We've had the post office, the police, Hillsborough, and basically they failed the British public in their attempt to cover it up. Can we ever trust the British state again? What do you think, James?
I think it's absolutely despicable for him. I mean, look, as the British Prime Minister, he has to apologise on behalf of the British government, I think. So, you know, that's kind of a formality. You'd expect that as a Prime Minister. However, I think it's pretty despicable, the fact that over the past sort of couple of years, they've ignored excess deaths. They've gaslighted the vaccine injured, and there are thousands of them. You know, lots of people haven't had compensation. So I think it's absolutely despicable that you've got all these politicians coming out now virtue signalling after their behaviour over the last 3-4 years.
No, absolutely. What do you think, Rick?
Well, I think it's also worth noting as part of this discussion, Andrew, that Sunak was not sparing on who he directed the blame for this to go towards. So, for example, he talked about the NHS, he talked about civil service, he talked about ministers and successive government, people and institutions which we place our trust afield in the most harrowing and devastating way, but also worth noting that this was brought to his attention a year ago. He was accused of deepening victims' pain by not setting up a compensation scheme a year ago when it was first recommended by Langstaff. So Sunak might be saying it's a day of shame and, you know, pointing the finger of blame left, right and centre. But, you know, when you point the finger, as they say, Andrew, there's three fingers pointing back at you as well. So he's been aware of this for quite some time and has done absolutely nothing about it for at least the last 12 months when he could have done. So he can pontificate all he like about compensation schemes and we're going to get this done. He could have set this ball rolling a year ago, but he didn't.
No, you make a very good point. And actually, I think it's probably less than three fingers. I think in some instances it'd have been two fingers telling people to go away. We've very interestingly got a caller. Let's go to the lines if we can. I think we have Frank calling in. Frank, welcome to the show. Thank you very much for calling in. Do we have Frank? It's quite a bad line, Frank. Speak to us. Tell us what you'd like to say.
I have to say, welcome to the show, Andrew. It's excellent. I'd also like to say, we've got Richard Sunak, but the part of the big pharma company.
You're talking about part of the pharma. It's a bit difficult to hear you, Frank. I think what you're saying is thank you very much for the show. Appreciation is always appreciated, which is great.
Andrew, he might be referring to the fact that Rishi Sunak, via the hedge fund that he set up, he's heavily invested into Moderna. And of course, the British government have given Moderna millions to set up manufacturing. So there's a real conflict. I think that's what he was talking about. There's a conflict of interest with the British Prime Minister.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. I think we're going to take a little break now. I think that's what they said in my ear. I assume that. Thank you very much to Frank for calling in. Do call in, and if you can make sure you've got a great line, we'll be able to hear you even better. But you're looking, listening and watching to the Mudrakers. We'll be straight back after this break.
TNT's Chris Smith.
The eSafety Commissioner not only censored video of an act of terror from a Wakeley church in Sydney's West, she tried to do the same around the world. And a lot of people were saying, who the hell does she think she is? Well, she's only just begun. Thanks to Craig Kelly of One Nation, we now discover through documents filed in the federal court that the eSafety censorship czar has been monitoring your social media posts, making a list, yes, like Santa Claus, who's been making critical comments against her. Against her? She's coming after you because you dared to have an opinion about her performance.
Chris Smith on today's News Talk, TNT.
In a democracy, the majority vote rules. But in most democracies, you can only vote for change every 3 or 4 years. To understand what people want, governments and political parties use focus groups. These focus groups can include as little as 20 people. Australia is a country of over 25 million people. Does making decisions based on 20 people sound fair to you? Have your say. Be heard in between elections. Download the For My Say app now. That is number 4, My Say.
It's time to switch on
today's News Talk Radio.
Very entertaining.
Yeah! TNT.
Well, welcome back. It's Andrew Eborn here with the Muckrakers, glorious second day. And we are spoiling you with TNT royalty, Rick Munn and James Freeman. And we're discussing the heavyweight topics, the blood infection scandal. And it has been a scandal which has dragged on for far too long. We've had Frank already called in with his opinions, talking about looking at the big pharma involvement and Rishi's further involvement. Another name that's been bandied around, gentlemen, is Ken Clark. And he's been named in the report as part of the cover-up. And people have suggested that he lose his peerage. Are they right? Let's start with you, James.
Look, somebody needs to be held accountable. Obviously, this happened, all of this, before the corporate manslaughter rules came in. So, you know, people can't necessarily be held account in the corporations that were involved in this. But somebody needs to be held account because, like we see in all these court cases in America, with Big Pharma, you know, they're fined billions and billions of pounds. In this case, it's us, the taxpayers, which have got to pick up the bill. 10 billion, I believe, is going to be. But the point is, it just becomes part of business, all of this. Big Pharma just pays their fines. They've made an extra, you know, 2-3 times that amount in profit, and nobody is ever held accountable. So somebody needs to be held accountable for what happened.
Yeah, no, absolutely. What's your thought, Rick?
Well, with any situation like this, Andrew, they need a scapegoat. They need somebody, at least one person, to be made an example of in the hope that maybe if we sacrifice this lamb on the altar of the blood infection scandal, maybe it'll all blow over and go away. They can point the finger towards Ken Clark. But in Sunak's own words, as we're referencing in this article here, he's mentioning the civil service, he's mentioning the NHS, he's mentioning government ministers, he's mentioning successive governments over decades. So to be fair, if Ken Clark's going to get it in the neck, I won't be against that per se, but he shouldn't be the only person. He should not be the sacrificial lamb that allows this to blow over and fade into history. So if they go after Clark and they remove his peerage, well, there should be a hell of a lot of other people in the firing line as well as Ken. That's my opinion. It shouldn't just be focused in on one person.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And it's not just a political issue, because it's cross-party and it has been going on for decades. And as I say, I've been talking to some of the victims. I asked them their reaction to the message from Rishi Sunak and indeed from Keir Starmer. And they said they actually liked his apology, the wording. They felt it was sincere. They felt as though they'd got justice once and for all. But they're exhausted, having gone on for months and months and months. Let me turn to another topic now, which is obviously getting everybody going. And I always always sort of say that if you want to draw a crowd, start a fight. Well, many fights around the world. The International Criminal Court has now requested the arrest warrant for a number of individuals, Benjamin Netanyahu over war crimes, but he's not alone because they're looking at the other side as well. And Israel has lashed out at the ICC after it requested an arrest warrant for Prime Minister Netanyahu over war crimes. And the prosecutor, British prosecutor Karim Khan, said yesterday he's seeking warrants not just for Netanyahu, but Israeli defense minister, as well as three Hamas leaders. Do you consider Netanyahu a war criminal, James?
Certainly do. I think the evidence shows that he's a war criminal. I mean, look, even before October the 7th, if you look back for the past 20 years before that, more than 2,000 children were shot dead by IDF soldiers and Israeli settlers on occupied land. And this was all before October the 7th attacks. Now, tens of thousands of innocent children and adults have also been bombed to death, and more than a million denied food and water and moved from place to place. I think the evidence speaks for itself, to be honest with you.
I think it is interesting, isn't it? And there's some appalling images I was seeing on the news just before we came on air about how Palestinian basic prisoners are being treated and tortured, basically, are those sort of images. All of this needs to be investigated. What are your views, Rick?
Well, very much I would agree with what James has said. Netanyahu is, without a shadow of a doubt in my mind, not just a war criminal, but he's an unhinged psychopath as well. But let's not just keep focusing in on him, which we should be doing at this moment in time. You know, look at our own leaders, our own so-called elected representatives, the like of Tony Blair, for example, arguably a war criminal. Barack Obama, war criminal. George Bush, war criminal. Hillary Clinton, war criminal. There's so many warmongers out there. It's almost a little bit like the Ken Clark thing. You know, we could make an example of him and label him as a war criminal, haul him in front of a justice panel and see justice served upon him, which would be fantastic. But let's not let all the other warmongers wriggle off the hook at the same time, because it takes more than one person to make a war. And as far as this business goes about arresting Netanyahu as well, they're not going to arrest Netanyahu. It was the same last year, I believe, Vladimir Putin was visiting South Africa, and there was talk about the BRICS community arresting him when he set down in Johannesburg. Who's going to arrest Vladimir Putin? Who would have had the audacity to do that, especially with his protective service around him? So I think they're calling for action. They're calling for drastic action, but in reality, Andrew, I can't see him ever. Can you see him being clapped in irons and led off as a war criminal at this point in time? He's too many backers in the West. It's not going to happen.
Well, it is interesting, isn't it, both Rick and James, because the whole idea about justice, it's supposed to be blind. And I guess by saying we're going to issue warrants, and they are just arrest warrants, everybody's innocent until proven guilty. It's an arrest warrant to say they've got sufficient evidence to basically investigate it. And we do have to question everything. So what do you think then is the solution to the conflict in Israel?
Well, I think we need a ceasefire, but the whole thing is in a right old mess, isn't it? I mean, it's, you know, we've talked about a two-state solution for years now, but pretty difficult to see how that can happen now. We've got 800,000 Israeli settlers on occupied land. It's very, very doubtful that the Israeli government, even if it was persuaded to, could actually move nearly a million people off that land. So the whole thing is a total mess. And I will comment as well on settlers, because while all of the TV cameras and all of the papers are focused on what is going on in Gaza, there is huge amounts of violence against Palestinians by Israeli settlers. The UN rights chief, Volker Turk, says Israeli settler violence has basically escalated after October the 7th, making it almost impossible now to resolve this and to create the solution, which lots of people still are talking about, which is just crazy. How are you going to sort this out? I mean, Gaza has been flattened. You've got 800,000 settlers on occupied land. The whole thing is quite frankly a mess. And I really don't know how to answer that, Andrew.
No, I think it is extraordinary. And we always forget, and I always make the point, that we get desensitized, don't we, to the issues as soon as you just look at statistics and the images of war, which we see virtually every day. We're drowning in that information. And I always say that the first casualty of war is the truth. And that's what we try and do here on TNT, unpack the truth. Let's hear from both sides. But it does raise an interesting question, though, Rick, then. Whose hands is the blood of both Israelis and Palestinians on?
Well, it's on multiple sets of hands, Andrew. And guys, I think even if there's a ceasefire, let's say there's a ceasefire today, there's no more ordnance dropped, there's no more bullets fired, the death will continue. And the reason why I'm saying the death will continue is a ceasefire in and of itself is not enough. So this ICC issued arrest applications for Netanyahu and Gallant for the use of starvation as a method of war, including cutting off cross-border water pipelines from Israel into Gaza. So even if they stop bombing the place, and they stop shooting and they stop with the physical violence, starvation, the lack of water, disease is running rampant throughout these refugee camps as well. And of course, aid has been blocked from getting in there. So a ceasefire in and of itself is not enough. They need to throw open the borders to allow all aid in that needs to be brought into those people to stop them from starving to death. So it's worth remembering here that this is not just about bombs and bullets. This is not just about people being displaced. There's people being starved and being cut off from medical supplies and aid by international agencies as part of this ongoing assault. So a ceasefire in and of itself will not accomplish the loss of life over in Gaza in the Middle East.
No, it's absolutely appalling. And I guess, well, is there a danger that the atrocities of October the 7th get lost in all of this, James? What do you think?
Look, I mean, I'll start off by saying there's a lot of questions about that attack on the October the 7th. Egypt, one of their ambassadors, spoke publicly about warning Israel that this was coming. We know Israel, in terms of their spying apparatus, their surveillance, is beyond the capabilities of most countries in the world. We also know that border wall is the most heavily fortified and surveilled. They've got lasers. They've got and yet we're told that flimsy paragliders were able to fly across that wall, something that, to be honest with you, you're going to shoot something out of the sky. I can't think of anything easier to shoot out of the sky. It is incredible. And there's a lot of questions, I think, question marks about what the Israelis knew and why it took them so long to stop this attack. But anyway, putting that aside, remind me what the question is, Andrew.
Well, the whole thing is about the atrocity on October the 7th. Is it going to get lost in all of this?
I think, look, there's a lot of misinformation as well. I think the Israelis have been forced to admit that those 1,200 deaths, there were quite a large number of those deaths were actually killed by the Israeli gunships, their helicopter planes that were trying to get at Hamas. Clearly, there was a lot of violence on that day. I've got no time for Hamas, whatever. They are a terrorist group. And what they did on that day is absolutely terrible. But that doesn't justify what Israel has gone on to do. And I've heard all of this about, I've had, the leader of UKIP now, Lewis Perry, come on here and talk about babies in ovens and all that. I've watched a Double Down News documentary with proper investigative journalists who've looked at this. And there's a lot of misinformation, I'll tell you, about what actually happened on that day. Clearly, lots of people died. There was lots of violence. But, I think people need to be very, very careful about believing all these stories about babies and ovens and all the rest of it.
You absolutely have to question everything. And it is extraordinary. You make a very good point, October the 7th, because the Israeli security system and force is supposed to be one of the best in the world. How on earth did they manage to get through? And you also have to ask yourself, and say you're questioning the things, the timing of this, because Benjamin Netanyahu has a few questions at home to answer himself. And I'm always reminded of that film, that great film, Wag the Dog. You know it well.
Hmm. Yes, I do. And Andrew, just before you pass over to Rick, I do want to say as well, there are trillions of cubic feet of gas off of Gaza, which is owned by the Palestinians. There is a plan in place for that. Israel want their hands on the licenses. They also want to build a canal so that they can deliver gas to Europe, which has got its own energy problem. So you have to ask as well, especially with all the question marks over 7th of October and how it was allowed to happen, whether this is a pretext actually for a much bigger, wider plan. That's not, I'm not saying that that's definitely the case, but there are some serious questions, you know, with a lot of evidence behind them that need answering, I think.
Well, and you're absolutely right. We do have to question everything. The good news is Frank, determined as he is to be part of this show, has called back on a better line. So hopefully we'll hear him this time. Frank, welcome to the show. Hopefully we can hear you now.
Hello, Andrew. Good to talk to
Hurrah!
You.
Hurrah! There we go. A much better line. The hamsters are working well.
Now we're on a different subject. I shall change tack. And we're talking about Israel and Gaza and what have you, the Israeli government and Hamas. And I think it's important to remember there are three sides to every argument. And that's one is one side's view, and the other one is the other side's view. And then the third one is context. Sometimes you're getting one side's view, the other side's view, but you've got to understand that what they're not saying is as important, and also that they're also saying according to their own perspective. So we have to sort of understand that what's going on behind all what we're actually seeing on the media or hearing is not necessarily everything. So, for example, October the 7th was not just the event itself, was also Putin's birthday, and that is context. You see what I mean?
No, a very interesting point. And we were discussing, I mean, James made the point about obviously oil and gas and energy and so on and so forth. What do you think the real reasons? You say there might be some real reasons. Do you have any views on what the real reasons might be behind apart from Putin's birthday?
Well, I mean, Iran is obviously sort of a Russian ally, and America is obviously an Israeli ally. As far as gas is concerned, I mean, obviously gas is very important. I mean, you've got gas off Gaza, you've got gas untapped in the Donbass, you've got gas potentially under the West Bank itself. So I mean that is also important, but I mean there are various sort of also when you're thinking of sort of proxy wars, you must be thinking in terms of Sudan because Port Sudan was going to be a possible site for a Russian naval base.
So do you think, let me just put you on the spot a bit then, Frank, do you think that Netanyahu his response is, do you think it's genocide, or do you think it's a fair and reasonable retaliation for the attack on October the 7th?
Well, genocide is a very emotive word, isn't it? Obviously, an awful lot of people have been killed, an awful lot of people have been displaced, and it can be interpreted in various ways. I mean, there are people that say we stand with Israel, other people that say we stand with Palestine, but the important thing is to do is stand with humanity.
No, I absolutely agree. Frank, thank you so much for your call, Frank, and thank you for being so resilient and determined to get through to the show. It's always great to hear voices from around the world. Do call in again. Interesting point, though, isn't it, gentlemen? Because if arrest warrants are issued for foreign states defending themselves, then where does this leave people like Bush and Blair who attacked a sovereign state? What do you think, Rick?
Well, I'll just say one thing on this business of genocide. Our caller there rightly pointed out that it's a very emotive term. And if you were to ask most people to define what it actually means, maybe they'd say, oh, well, it's the mass destruction of an entire country or group of people, eradicating them off the face of the earth. That's not necessarily the actual definition. Let me just read this out. Genocide is an internationally recognized crime. So number one, it's a crime and it is internationally recognized, where acts are committed with the intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group. So it's not the eradication, you know, of an entire group of people. It can be in whole or in part, and it can be based on certain demographics. So you know, people have, when you mention that word genocide, various images are conjured up in people's heads of events in history. But it doesn't necessarily have to be millions of people being wiped out. It could be the focus on one small ethnic group of people. It is a crime, and it is an internationally recognized thing, which I think we're leading into, you know, what you were discussing originally, this point about Netanyahu and the ICC and the arrest warrants being issued and so on and so forth. You don't issue that without a suspected crime being going on, and this is being recognized on an international stage as well. So it's very important to understand what genocide actually is, as well as what it isn't.
Yeah, I know it's important to put into historical context. As you say, it came out of, as a result of the Nazi atrocities and so on and so forth, to make sure history doesn't repeat itself. And sadly, the reason history repeats itself is because we don't learn the lessons, which is why we do need to question everything. But going back to that original question, where do you think it leaves Bush and Blair and others who attacked a sovereign state? Rick?
Wow.
Well, they have to be tarred with the same brush. When you look back at what happened in the Middle East with Iraq, with what happened with the displacement of Saddam Hussein, you know, there was lies told on the international stage by Blair and by the American administration. Those lies resulted in the death of millions of innocent Iraqis. That's a fact, in much the same way as the events of October the 7th are leading to the deaths of tens of thousands innocent Gaza residents, women, children, non-combatants. So there's no justification for that whatsoever. And of course, you have to question everything, like you rightly pointed out. And do we even have the answers to all this? I don't think we do.
That's right. James, I know, I'm sure you wanted to make a couple of points on that.
Yeah, I think people around the world, citizens that are far too captured by their phones, by Netflix, by cinema and all of that nonsense, they need to start waking up, because you know, I think most people just think, oh, well, as long as they're keeping us safe, I don't need to worry about what's going on the other side of the world. But the truth is, what's been going on over the past 40, 50 years, led by America, led by NATO, these wars that keep on getting started, they're making us all more unsafe. And I think this war in the Middle East does have the potential to infect. Well, we've already seen it in the UK. You know, we've got large Muslim population here, we've got a large Jewish population, and you know, this conflict has been going on for 70 years. It's created a real evil in that area, you know, conducted by both sides, evils, but there is an evil energy there now which is almost unsolvable. And I just think the danger with all of this, with all of these conflicts across the world, is they will come back to bite us. So that is my final message. People, if you're watching this and you just think, don't need to worry about that, that's another part of the world, wake up, because you know it will be on our shores if we do not put a stop the politicians and the corporations in their warmongering around the world. This is big business for right. You know, for defense companies, make no, you just look at their share prices, they've been going through the roof.
It's absolutely appalling. I'm sure we'll return to this topic lots of times. I want to raise another one with you, though, is the UN holds a minute's silence for the Iranian prime minister. And despite earning the nickname of the Butcher of Tehran for presiding over Iran's human rights abuses, the United Nations yesterday held a moment of silence for Ebrahim Raisi after the Iranian president died in a helicopter crash. Israeli UN ambassador called for a moment of silence in memory of Raisi. He said it was a disgrace that they did that. What are your views on that, gentlemen? Let's start with you, Rick.
Hypocrisy, just what you would expect, really. Why not just call a spade and just say, we're not going to recognize this man. He had a nickname of the Butcher. Okay, so anybody that has a nickname of the Butcher, I don't think anybody should be reverencing in any way, shape or form. So for the UN to come together and stand together for a minute's silence for this chap who died in that helicopter crash, maybe had some friends in the UN. If you want to stand and recognize his death, do it. But these token gestures that we're seeing, you remember the tour that Vladimir Zelensky did last year. He was beamed into Westminster. He was beamed into the American Parliament. He was treated like a, you know, given standing ovations everywhere he went. Do you honestly think the people in all those parliaments were a supporter of that little leech? I don't think so, but they stood with a smile on their face and they stood and they clapped and they give him standing ovations. It's just another virtue signaling exercise. The same as Rishi Sunak apologizing for the blood scandal. Virtue signaling, hypocrisy, rank hypocrisy, makes me want to be sick, if the truth be told, Andrew.
And if only you had an opinion. No, absolutely. We are very clear. I think that's absolutely right. James, what are your views?
I have to agree with Rick, and I'll go further. I'll say, you know, the Israeli UN ambassador, Gilad Erdan, said, he said the moment of silence in memory of mass murdering Razi is a disgrace. Well, I think hypocrisy also comes into this as well, because I don't think Israel have got any platform to stand on at the moment to call out others in terms of war crimes and conflicts around the world.
No, you're very, very interesting. And do you think, I mean, a lot of people have been speculating, and this is what always happens when any sort of accidents happen, accidents in inverted commas. Do you think it was an accident, or do you think it was engineered, Rick?
To be honest, I have no idea, in that it could very well have been just simply an accident. Helicopter. I don't understand, Andrew, if the truth be told, why rich people decide to take helicopters to travel from A to B. It's a very prestigious thing to have a helipad. It's a very prestigious thing to have your own helicopter. But if you're going to die in the sky, the chances are very high that it will be as a result of a helicopter crash. So Middle East, apparently there was fog around there. Maybe it wasn't a well-maintained helicopter. Maybe the pilot was a little bit drunk. Maybe was shot down by a surface-to-air missile. I don't know, but what I do know is the guy is dead, and now we're dealing with the fallout from it. So it's highly possible it was an accident. It's equally possible it was engineered, but either way, the end result is the same. No more Iranian prime minister or president. Yeah,
you're absolutely right. I've taken a few helicopter rides in my time. I took one from Nice down to Cannes for the film festival, and some of the most terrifying moments. You're right. It feels terribly unstable, but let's have a look at that sort of side. You're listening to today's News Talk TNT. We're going to be right back after this break.
From weather and traffic reports to news of political developments, we turn to journalists for the information we need to live our daily lives.
Journalists around the world provide the news that is essential for democracy,
for personal freedom, and for safety and stability.
Yet their ability to report freely and safely is under attack like never before.
So many journalists are paying with their lives.
They face exponential risks, and they've already paid a heavy toll.
Death threats, online harassment, and physical attacks
are becoming a daily experience of journalists in all countries.
Absolutely.
We just want people to be safe, to be able to get our readers the information that they need to make informed decisions.
They checked my phone and realized that it was Pegasus. I feel myself like I'm naked in the street.
These charges were politicized from the start.
Facts win. Truth wins. Justice wins.
C'est énorme pour moi d'être là, d'être libre. Surtout que je m'y attendais pas du tout.
Stand with a free press.
Stand with journalists whose reporting won't be silenced. Press freedom is your freedom.
Asthma is a growing problem, especially among children. Asthma affects the quality of life for millions like me every single day. My name is Chris Draft, and I have asthma. And I've spent more than a decade in the NFL tackling asthma on and off the field. Join me in the EPA in helping people control their asthma. Asthma is a lung condition that can be controlled through medication and by avoiding things that can make it worse. Three steps are the solution to controlling asthma. Step one, talk to a doctor. Step two, make a plan. And step three, get rid of things that can make it worse. Asthma can be tackled. For more information on asthma, log on to epa.gov/asthma.
This is The Muckrakers on today's News Talk, TNT.
Well, welcome back, and thank you so much for everybody who's getting in touch. You are indeed watching The Muckrakers with me, Andrew Ewan, and the wonderful panel of Rick Munn and James Freeman, TNT's finest. Well, Michael Gove has been in touch, and not only has he been in touch, we've had a few callers as well. We've had Frank on the line, who was brilliant earlier, and he's very determined. I'd love to hear more of your opinions as well. This is how you can get in touch with us.
This is the way we're going to be heard.
From the U.S. and Canada, call 1-888-201-6425. From the U.K., call 033-0024-1026. And from Australia and New Zealand, call 1-800-670-310. Free speech is alive and well on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
And I have to say, it is essential. People always complain, especially in social media, they say there's no platforms where they can air their opinions. Well, that's wrong. The truth is there is a platform. It's called TNT, and no more so than here on the Muckrakers. We would love to hear from you, and indeed on the other Brilliant Gentlemen's shows as well. We're talking about hearing from somebody. We heard from Michael Gove, the Community Secretary, this morning, a long speech. He basically said that pro-Palestinian protesters who chant from the river to the sea are seeking the erasure of Israel. And this comes at a time when Lord Walney, the government's extremism czar, has called for more police powers to refuse permission of such rallies. Now, I was listening to the speech just before we came on air. But first of all, let's have a look, though, at the police powers. Are they right? Do they need more powers to stop these rallies? What do you think, James?
Look, the police are always going to ask for more powers on everything. So, they're always going to, and that's just the way of the police. Getting those powers back is very, very difficult. I think there's been a lot of politicking about this whole thing. These rallies, yes, okay, there are some extremists there. And to be honest with you, the freedom rallies that we saw 3-4 years ago, there's always, when you get tens or hundreds of thousands of people together, if you know about psychology and you know about the normal distribution curve, you're always going to get those extremists. It's inevitable. But, I've watched those rallies and I would say that the majority of people there are peaceful. They're there for the right reasons. And you've also, by the way, got thousands of Jewish people supporting those rallies and joining in as well, calling for a ceasefire. It's clear that the Israeli government has an awful lot of power over the British government, over the US, via its powerful lobbies in the US. There's millions that flow in via, lobby groups like AIPAC, which is essentially a front for the Israeli government, but it's been given an exemption. There's a whole story about that. I won't go down that rabbit hole now. But I think, if we start to give the police more powers, then which protest in the future will it be that they say you can't protest again? Will it be, well, digital ID, you can't protest against that, or CBDCs? I think this is very dangerous territory for freedom-loving people. I think the police have got enough powers as it is to police these protests.
Well, you make a very interesting point, because I agree with you. There are lots of powers there which they can do under the Terrorism Act for anybody who's shown to be supporting a prescribed terrorist organisation. And Hamas is, however long it took a lot of people to say that, Hamas is a terrorist organisation. It was an act of terrorism, and we need to look at that sort of side. But the police have powers already. The question is, why are they not using those powers? What do you think, Rick?
Well, it's incompetence. Look at the people that are running the various police forces around the country. They're more interested in wokeism. They're more interested in diversity hires. They're more interested in inclusivity, wearing rainbow badges out and parading around the streets once a year to try and integrate well with their communities rather than actually tackling crime. So the lack of power isn't the problem with the police at the minute. You look at the rogues gallery of police commissioners that there's been and the incompetence that they've exhibited time after time after time. The problem is not a lack of power, much the same as the NHS. The woes that are happening in the NHS is not a result of underfunding. It's mismanagement and too many middle managers and too many Indians or chiefs and not enough Indians, as the saying goes here. So the last thing the British police need is more power. They need proper leadership. They need adequate management, and also they need to have, competent people recruited into their forces based on meritocracy, their ability to do the job, not because they're short, fat, white man. We don't have enough of them. Get Rick Munn in there. We need some black lesbians in there. Let's tick a few boxes there. No, you need people that can do the job. Forget about diversity hires. I don't care, Andrew, if the entire police force is black women who are lesbians. I don't care, as long as they can do the job. Or if it's all Welshmen, 5'4" Welshmen, for crying out loud, let's bring back merit into the police force recruitment, not diversity hires and box ticking. That's one of the reasons why we're in this ungodly mess that we're in now, even talking about it.
I have to say, Rick, I absolutely agree with you across all things. Whilst I absolutely support equality and diversity to a certain extent, I appalled by the effect it's had on certain sections where we've lost quality. And that's what we need to do. We need quality people. We need to get to a stage where it is a meritocracy. The best person, regardless of color, creed, sexuality, any of that sort of stuff. We want the best people for the job. But we also need clarity of communication. And the real problem is this, is that people don't really understand what they're supposed to do, it seems, from the police point of view. And we had an example of the person who was stopped from going into the heart of a march, if you might remember this. And the police officer turned around to them and said, you look Jewish. You remember this? And they sort of said, you can't go over there because you look Jewish. Well, the other side of that, well, maybe they were trying to protect that individual from coming to harm if there was a likelihood. What are your views on that, James?
That was a total political stunt. The guy's an activist, an Israeli activist. And look, what he was trying to do with his camera crew, by the way, is walk against the flow of the march. He was there to provoke people and then to get it caught on camera to show that these marches need to be stopped, because look at these extremists and the way they've reacted. Now, the police in a situation like that, where you've got hundreds of thousands of people on the ground, their first priority is safety, is to keep the peace, right? So they were trying to protect him and also stopping things getting out of control, because, you know, when they do get out of control, it's their officers which have got to go in and sort things out. You know, what really shocked me about that whole situation, though, is because there's lots of this going on at the moment, is the fact that the British Prime Minister weighed into this situation and said it's disgusting that this police officer talked about the fact that you're Jewish. I think the police officer could have picked his words more carefully. But essentially what he was saying is, look, you're here to provoke them. If you listen to the full conversation, you're here to provoke them. I'm here to keep the peace. We're not going to let you go ahead with that. That was the message, which is why I'm here to keep the peace. We're not going to let you go ahead with that. That was the message, which is why the chief police officer in London backed that policeman, and there's no action being taken against him.
Yeah, it goes back to the point I was making earlier about communication, because you're absolutely right. When somebody turns up with a camera and they start filming things, you've got to question everything. Why are they doing that? Is it deliberately going to be provocative? Because also from the police point of view, and it's important that we air all sides of this debate. Mm-hmm. From the police point of view, it seemed to me from that sort of side, he was trying to avoid what was clearly going to be an inflammatory situation. Is that fair, Rick?
Well, listen, whatever happened to common sense here? Whatever happened to common sense? Why does the ring have to be politicized and broken down into ethnic backgrounds? The bottom line is the policeman was doing his job. He saw a man that if he went ahead with where he was going, he could have ended up getting bashed, maybe, but there was no guarantee of that happening either. So he was warning him and said, listen, sir, and as somebody said there, it might have been James, maybe he could have chosen his words more carefully, or maybe not. Maybe he was just trying to stop the guy from getting harmed. Think about it like this. Imagine if it was an old firm derby or an old firm football game in Glasgow. You've got Rangers versus Celtic. If a policeman sees a man in a Celtic top about to go into a Rangers pub, he might say, you might want to do that because you could get seriously injured. Now, if the guy decides to ignore the policeman, then on his own head be it. The cop should have just said, excuse me, sir, going down that route may not be a good idea because of the nature of the march and because of what I perceive your background to be. At that point, if the man wanted to proceed, the cop should have just let him. And as the old saying goes, F-A-F-O. F around, find out. That's one way to teach people a lesson if they don't listen to common sense.
Well, it's certainly
I was going to say, the only problem with that, though, is that if it does, because look, he was going to walk against the flow of the march. If it did kick off, then it's that policeman's colleagues which have got to go in, and suddenly they're dealing with a very, very dangerous situation. So yeah, I agree with you.
Can they stop his freedom of movement? I agree. Yes, it would have been inflammatory and it could have caused an absolute unholy row. Or maybe nothing would have happened, which would have actually burst the bubble of the guy that came down to do the stunt in the first place. If the cops had let him walk against the march and the people peacefully parted and let him prance straight up the middle, it would have shot every hole in that guy's argument. But where do you draw the line? That's the problem. Should the cop have physically restrained him because it might have caused the public disorder? Well, I don't think we're ever going to know, you know.
I think that, look, as we've already discussed, there's always extremists at these. You know, when you get 100,000 people, there's always going to be a few extremists. All it takes is for one person to kick off. Suddenly somebody else gets thrown, drawn in by accident. And before you know it, you've got a real problem on your hands. I do accept what you're saying, Rick. You know, we should let idiots learn the hard way. But I think, you know, the police's first priority in that situation is to protect public property and also to keep the peace and make sure that it goes off safely. That has to be their number one priority. Otherwise, we've seen what happens when we have riots in recent decades in the UK. You know, it could spill out and before you know it, absolute chaos and people lose their lives. So that's my view on the situation.
Yeah, and I think in the same way as with the Orange Marches, probably a bit closer to home, Rick, the Orange Marches, they have a designated route, so you don't go into certain areas which would clearly be inflammatory.
Correct. And not every Orange March is valid. And a lot of people that come to watch those Orange Marches are from both sides of the community. So, you know, again, it's based on the premise that, oh, if this happens, then this will be the definite outcome. It doesn't always happen that, but that's why the policing's there. It's to prevent flashpoints developing and prevent possible public order, occurrences. But then again, there's no guarantee that that'll ever happen in the first place or that they would prevent them anyway. So, yeah, it's on a case-by-case basis, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let me move on to another subject. What I love in this show is we try to unpack as many different things as possible, and we're going to basically come back to them because we want to encourage debate across all of these things. And I do think it's jaw, not war. Let's get those informed decisions. But there's a survey which has just come out. I don't know if you saw it, but nearly half of people expect a cashless society within their lifetime. And a survey basically said that one in six people said they never carry cash on their person, a figure which is more than triple the 4% of people who said this in 2019. The proportion of people expecting to see the UK go cashless in their lifetime has also increased from just over 2/5 when similar research was carried out in 2019. And cash access and ATM network link, basically, they're looking at that sort of side. What are your views? Do you still carry cash, James?
Yes, I do. I take every opportunity to take cash out because, look, I've got a nuanced view on this. I think digital money is inevitable because I just think, you know, if you think about, I don't know, 100 years time, for example, when we've got flying cars and all that kind of gubbins that you expect that we'll have, it's pretty hard to believe that we'll still be carrying around bits of paper. So I think at some point it's inevitable and actually it offers huge benefits. So for example, you know, with crypto, true crypto, not government-controlled money, you can cut out the middlemen. You don't need banks taking their profits anymore. You can have insurance via smart contracts. It offers a huge opportunity to cut out all of these greedy bankers who are taking their cut of all of the transactions which goes on. So I think, actually, digital money, there's huge opportunities. However, the reason I support not doing it at the moment is because I don't trust the government. Like everything else, don't trust them. I mean, look, there's opportunities with digital ID. Imagine people being able to vote in elections on their phone and getting, you know, nearly 100% turnout. It would turn over elections. But again, I don't trust the government. The government is the problem here, I think, with all of this.
Yeah, and you make a very interesting point about banks. I mean, banks are just intermediaries, and a lot of economists basically have written banks out in their predictions for the future. But do you think it's too late to prevent this, Rick? Is it inevitable?
It's not inevitable, but having said that, you can't ignore the trends that are happening at the minute. And let's be honest, with the new generation that's coming up now, kids, teenagers, early 20s, that have all they've ever known is digitization. They don't know what a landline is. They don't know what a VCR is. They don't know what a Sony Walkman is. Everything is digital. It's almost like that's what they're conditioned to do. So you'll find, I believe, a lot more cash usage with older people, dare I say it, people of our age and older that don't want to let go of that facility. And the elderly in particular would be at the opposite end of the spectrum. That's all they've ever known. That's all they ever want to deal with and all they ever can deal with, because some of them don't have bank accounts and debit cards. So we're in this funny phase at the minute, guys, where I think without a doubt, we've seen a shift towards digital transactions, everything being conducted online. But I do believe cash should always remain in circulation as an option for those people that want to use it. I think if it ever disappears and disappears completely, we're going to be in a very dark and dangerous place if we're digital only.
No, and I think you're right. And what we have to do is to make sure we deal with all aspects of society. I'm a big advocate as a futurist. I speak around the world about what's going to happen in the future. And undoubtedly, things will become digital. It's crazy to carry so many different devices, bits of paper, different cards. Everything will be centralized. But you have to make sure there are people who are not tech savvy, those who do rely and want to have a note in their hands. Make sure we don't prejudice those. And there's a lot of things, like things like parking apps. I know lots of people who have absolute horrendous situation trying to park their car. They haven't got an app on their phone, or they don't have a smartphone. And you're therefore prejudicing a certain part of the society. And that's got to be wrong, hasn't it?
Yeah, of Steve. Course. It is wrong because, you know, I think at the moment, particularly you've got lots of people who are not necessarily technological savvy. That will change in the future. So the reason I support cash now is because I think we've got a limited time period here. We need to educate people about what this is about, because yes, we're going to move to digital money. I think that's inevitable, but we need to have anonymity put in place as standard. Sure, the police need to be able to access and investigate crimes, but you know, this shouldn't be linked to a digital ID. Absolutely, 100%. And we should have a system which is very much like it is now, whereas the government can only investigate you if things go wrong, rather than it all being a joined up system connected to every citizen.
No, you're absolutely right. You talk about anonymity. Well, I'll tell you about anonymity. At the moment, a wonderful court about things about the barrister's wigs. And the whole reason about barrister's wigs, apart from formality and about tradition, was to do and have anonymity in the court. And I've got one here because I am a barrister. There you go. So this is the thing. And the reason I put it on is it's been reported that the English courts could drop the requirement for barristers to wear wigs amid accusations that they're basically culturally insensitive. The judiciary is said to be in talks to update dress codes after some barristers complained the requirement to wear wigs discriminates against those with Afro-Caribbean hair. And judges are apparently reviewing proposals made by the Bar Council, which represents barristers across England and Wales. Any changes would be made in autumn at the earliest. Let me get your very quick views on that, Rick. What do you think?
I think we should each get one of those wigs for Thursday. That's what I think.